2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Anna Wilcox and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Danielle Smith. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuchner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. We are heading east today. So Oregon's Blue Mountains encompass some of the most beautiful landscapes and habitats that you'll find anywhere. Within the Blues' 15,000 square miles, you'll find Oregon gems like the John Day River, the Eagle Cap Wilderness, Hell's Canyon, and a surprisingly large percentage of Oregon's forests. But because they are geographically isolated from major population centers, they often don't get the recognition that they deserve. And that remoteness also makes them vulnerable to resource extraction. Right now, the Forest Service, which manages millions of acres of public land within the Blues, is revising their management plan under the most environmentally hostile administration in my lifetime. To learn more about this special part of Oregon and how to defend it, I'm joined today by Paula Hood, co-director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. Before we get to that, you can find Coast Range Radio free and ad-free on all podcast apps. And as always, huge thanks and gratitude to the community-supported radio stations that carry the show. And as I mentioned last week, I'm looking for volunteers to help produce the show. That means hosting, researching, editing, whatever, no experience necessary, and I'm happy to train folks. So to learn more about that, or if you have feedback, guest ideas, anything, you can email me at coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Okay, Paula Hood, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here, and I really appreciate the invite to come and speak about Eastern Oregon and the Blue Mountains. And so to start out a little bit about Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, so our mission is to protect and restore the ecosystems of the Blue Mountains and the Eastern Oregon Cascades. Our work focuses on national forests in Eastern Oregon and Southeastern Washington. And field surveying is the heart of the work that we do. We're in the field from the beginning of June through September every year, and our staff and the volunteers that we have out with us spend thousands of hours every field season surveying proposed timber sales. And we train those volunteers on map and compass skills, identifying plants and animals, measuring slope, identifying forest conditions, and how to quantify old growth, and more.
I'm so glad you started with that little intro to what the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is. And we're going to get deeper on what you all do and how folks can get involved with the organization. We're also going to go deep on the action that you're asking folks to take and the Forest Service revisions to their land management plans. Could you start us off with just a really brief overview of what is happening with the Forest Service revisions of their land management plans for the Blues and what you are asking people to do if they're listening to this before October 6th?
Yeah, so the Forest Service has recently begun the process of revising forest plans for the Malheur, Umatilla, and Wallah-Whitman National Forests on the Blue Mountains, and that encompasses about 5 million acres in eastern Oregon and southeastern Washington. What we're asking is that the public comment on these plans, and so if you're hearing this before October 6th, the deadline for public comments on their draft scoping plan is October 6th, but also, we're asking people to keep the pressure on the Forest Service. So even if you're hearing this after October 6th, email the Forest Service anyway. There will also be another opportunity for public comment when the Forest Service releases a more detailed version of their draft plan. We're not sure exactly when that's going to be, but please stay tuned and keep up with us. It's likely to be in the next several months that more detailed draft environmental impact statement plan gets released. Just to back up a little bit, just to say a brief word about what are forest plans. So forest plans are the basis for virtually all management actions in national forests. And that dictates everything from timber volume outputs to protections or lack of protections for wildlife and stream habitats. And they'll guide forest management for decades to come. And this will have lasting implications for the climate, for biodiversity, and for clean water. And so we really need the public voice and involvement and pressure to speak out for forests this time.
Thanks for that. I think right on the homepage of BlueMountainsBiodiversityProject.org, you've got links to this action alert that you have that tells people how to make comments, how to get involved, a lot of resources right there on your homepage.
Yes.
So actually, let's hold on the forest revision plan and what the Forest Service is trying to do. So could you give us just a real brief background on how long it's been since they've revised the forest plan, what some of the key things that were there, maybe some of the worst aspects and best aspects of the current forest plan. And then I'd love to hear what the Forest Service's proposed revisions are.
Yeah, so most of the forest plans for Eastside Forest were put in place in the 1980s, like the mid-80s, and then they were amended in the 90s. And so particularly those amendments in the 90s were the result of litigation that was likely to happen from environmental groups at the time, including BMBP being involved in that, Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. And so a lot of those amendments were actually very strong, helpful environmental protections. And so some of that, those amendments were known as the East Side Screens and Packfish Infish. And it was kind of the East Side equivalent of the Northwest Forest Plan, which you have on the West Side, which focused a lot on spotted owls and to some degree marbled murrelets. And so on the East Side, we don't have spotted owls except for a small sliver of the Cascades. But this was sort of the East Side answer to trying to protect what was severe declines in wildlife habitat, ecosystems, large trees, mature and old forests that was also happening on the East Side of the Cascades. And so the East Side Screens and Packfish Infish had very specific, or still have very specific quantitative standards. And so, for example, the East Side Screens, one of the main protections under that is protections for large and old trees. And so trees that are 21 inches in diameter or over are protected from logging. The Forest Service has found loopholes to that, and there are exceptions right along. There has been large tree logging, but it's been severely curtailed and oftentimes stopped by the East Side Screens. And one thing that I want to point out here is that a lot of the current forest plans that are existing in place right now have really strong quantitative standards, which are mandatory protections, which the Forest Service absolutely has to do or is supposed to. They actually get away with a lot, but in theory. And guidelines are a lot more squishy and subjective and discretionary and sort of are much harder to enforce. And so the old forest plans really do a much better job of having these very clear, enforceable standards. And unfortunately, now the Forest Service is moving towards much more squishy, discretionary guidelines that are extremely difficult to enforce.
Right. And that is a huge but easily overlooked distinction. So I assume that that's one of the big things that you're objecting to in the new proposed revisions. What are some of the other things that stick out that are problematic in what the Forest Service is trying to do on these lands?
So, for example, a couple of the things that we're particularly worried about is that Forest Service is rolling back and severely weakening protections for large trees. And the other thing that we're severely worried about is that the strong quantitative standards that have helped protect streams, aquatic organisms, water quality, and streamside forests are being so severely weakened that essentially the old forest plan protections that have really made a difference in helping these areas recover are going to be almost entirely stripped away.
Well, you got to cut the big trees to save the big trees, right? for listeners so that might not know, Paula and I know each other, so I knew that would get you there. But so we could talk, I'm sure, for a long time about why the Forest Service is wrong here in what they're trying to do, and maybe we should. But I also want to know what you are calling for. Like, what do you want to see in the revisions? Because obviously, status quo isn't perfect in your view either.
Yeah. So some of the broad brush highlights of the overarching vision that we have is that, you know, for starters, one of a good first important step is to protect the remaining mature and old forests in the Blue Mountains. And this includes the large and old trees. And, you know, if you're familiar with some of the recent studies that have been done in the Blue Mountains, Dr. David Muldrexler and others did a study that showed that there's only about the largest 3% of trees are the ones that are storing 42% of the carbon out there. And so it really seems important and like it's something that we should be able to do to protect the largest 3% of trees on the landscape. So that's one of the things that we're really focusing on. And, you know, unfortunately, as you alluded to, those current logging practices that we're seeing on the ground threaten mature and old forests and large as well as old trees. Even when old trees aren't targeted for logging, we've been doing more post-logging field surveying. And as part of timber sale implementation, we've really been alarmed at what we find all too often on the ground. That includes virtual clear cuts, you know, loss of really, you know, many, many old trees and large trees, including many old and large ponderous pine. So anyway, and then we also want to see strong protections for streams, fish, and water quality. And that needs to be a central component of any forest plan revision. And that needs to, again, include those standards rather than guidelines. Also, the Forest Service tends to not want to talk much about wildlife. And I think part of that is because, as far as I'm aware, no forest has ever been logged to restoration in a way that is particularly that is good for wildlife. So wildlife often gets ignored, and we really want to see strong protections for that prioritize wildlife and wildlife habitats, large habitat blocks, and landscape level connectivity. And going back a bit to David Muldrexler, who I just mentioned, his 2023 work shows basically that there is still the possibility to have some of these big blocks and their connectivity corridors protected on the landscape. And one of the cool things about Eastern Oregon and the east side is the Blue Mountains encompass these really important connectivity corridors that connect the Northern Rockies to the Cascades. And so for people who care about things like grizzlies, moose, wolverine, lynx, and all of these other species that are found primarily on the east side of the state, having that sort of connectivity is really important. And so David Muldrexler and other scientists have laid out this basically this blueprint for a Blue Mountains Forest Plan Reserve system. And so we think that the Forest Service should be genuinely trying to incorporate these ideas and analyze them as part of the vision for the Blue Mountains.
Yeah, the connectivity corridors. I mean, I should do a whole show on just that because it is such an important idea, whether folks are familiar with that or not. But we'll try to do an episode on that soon. So we can talk more about this if you want, but if folks, you know, maybe are just tuning in, If they're listening before October 6th, how do they learn more and take action? You know, when are these public comments due? Spoiler alert, it's when I said October 6th. And then if they're listening after, you know, how can they still take action to help?
So visit our website, and that's bluemountainsbiodiversityproject.org. And we have an action alert up as well as a landing page sort of just outlining some of our key vision points, linking to the Forest Service documents, instructions and links about how to comment on the Forest Service website. And so we're also asking people to get in touch with their elected representatives and ask their elected representatives to, you know, voice strong support for strong protections for forests to the Forest Service, and, you know, be a champion for these forests and for letting forests be a part of the climate solution and letting forests grow. And so there's links to all of this, how to find your elected representative, how to comment, deadlines, et cetera, on our webpage. So please visit our website and also sign up for our action alerts. And then, you know, we're also not the only group that is really engaged in this. So certainly please do follow us on our, sign up for our listserv, follow us on social media. You can go to our website. But then there's also like Greater Hell's Canyon Council is one of the leaders in this effort as well.
We could talk all episode just about the Forest Service revisions and the good, the bad, and the ugly, but I really want to spend some time talking about the work of Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project and the Blue Mountains themselves and, you know, what makes them so special, because they really are this just underappreciated gem of Oregon.
I'll start with the last question. So one of the things that's really cool about the Blue Mountains, too, is the just amazing diversity of forests that are out there. And so, you know, I also love ponderosa pine forest, but I think for a lot of people, if they think about forests of the east side of the state at all, they think about these dry, open ponderosa pine forests. Mm-hmm. And certainly those forests are iconic and important. But there's also just this amazing, you know, you can be in one area and walk not very long and not very far and go from these dry ponderosa pine forests or even like these upland meadows that, you know, are very dry and have sagebrush, and then be in just a short distance in a multi-story, dense, lush, mixed conifer forest that has a bunch of other forest tree species in it. And so, you know, I think that is something that a lot of people don't understand about the Blue Mountains, is how amazingly diverse the forest types actually are in this checkerboard mosaic often, which, you know, makes it also sort of very hard for the Forest Service to manage, so to speak. I'm not a fan of that word, but sorry, you can erase that.
No. Tell me how you feel.
But
well, it's clear that you love the Blue Mountains, and we could go into more detail because I think that probably a lot of folks, even folks that maybe have visited part of them, don't understand the full breadth of the diversity of species, of habitats, et cetera. But I want to shift the conversation a little bit as we start to wrap up and ask a couple maybe more esoteric questions or philosophical questions. So from my vantage point, the Trump administration's assaults on public lands are just coming from every angle right now. And obviously this administration is wholly unconcerned with legality, right? I'm really concerned that the conservation playbooks that most organizations rely on has stagnated and is in danger of becoming really outdated and ineffective. And even some of the more confrontational forest defense techniques that were so successful 30 or years ago or so, you know, law enforcement has caught up with how to deal with some of those techniques. So I'm curious if you, A, agree with that assessment, and if not, why not? And if so, like, what should we be doing to adapt to this new reality?
I agree with the assessment. I think it's not just true of the conservation community, but is true for a lot of other sorts of activism and attempts at public engagement across the board. And part of that is because we're seeing unprecedented attacks that don't play by the rule books. Uh-huh. And so people are, you know, have been, it's been somewhat successful that people are caught on their back foot and are flooded with being come at from every angle in all of these different attacks. And so, you know, that said, it does, you know, while it's not widely reported on as much as I think it should be or could be on mainstream news, people have been fighting back, and some of that has looked successful. And so, you know, unfortunately, I don't think anyone has a one silver bullet. Like, if we did, we would all be doing it.
Right.
And so, you know, it's I think, you know, I've heard some discussion out there that I think is really important. And one of the things that have stuck with me in listening to other conversations out in the world and podcasts, et cetera, is that, you know, it's hard to know in the moment if what you're doing is working. That's not how history works. And so, you know, and also that we've developed a rather transactional relationship to hope. And so, you know, like in order to have hope, you have to see success. And I want to be strategic. I want to succeed. But I also think that, you know, trying to band together, raise as much of our collective voices as possible in, you know, and certainly like do it, plan it strategically as much as we can. But at the same time, like if everything is like, well, we need a proven method that's going to succeed, that's new, I don't think anything has been proven because we're not that place in history. Like, you know, a lot of it is in retrospect. You realize that ideas took hold, movements were birthed, et cetera. And so, you know, while some of our methods are outdated, I do still think that they are also important and can be effective as our new ones. And, you know, I kind of think that it's a hodgepodge of things and a groundswell of loud voices that need to be as persistent and as loud as possible. And there's a whole variety of ways to do that. And I think to some extent, people are called to do different things in different ways. And instead of beating ourselves up and each other up about it, as much as possible, supporting and embracing those differences. And, you know, I don't live in a kumbaya world. Like, I'm not saying this is always perfect or that strategy isn't important, but, you know, that's, you know, I think we really just have to do the best with what we have. And so, for example, comment strategies, you know, while that is one of the things environmental groups have been relying on, and to some extent, we fully expect the Trump administration to ignore it. At the same time, we have seen groundswells for public lands in ways that have already been successful. And so, for example, the move to sell off public lands in, you know, some of the recent legislation that was largely killed. And I think that was because so many people spoke up about how upset they were about this. And so I do actually think that those comments can still make a difference, particularly in places that don't tend to get a lot of attention, like the East Side. And then also, you know, it's important for other things like providing standing for litigation. So, you know, while some of those things aren't as effective as they used to be in the same ways, they're certainly still very important parts of an overall strategy that I think does need to adapt more and have more people get engaged and involved.
Yeah. Well, I agree with all of that. And a couple things that came up while you were talking is, yeah, I wasn't trying to assert that kind of the entrenched playbook of a lot of the NGO community should be thrown out, right? But certainly people need to really be thinking about how we can adapt, how we can be creative. Like you say, we're not going to know what's effective until later, but we need to try new things and be creative and throw some things at the wall, not be afraid to fail at some endeavors, right? And that would be true whether it was the Trump administration or another administration, because we still have a lot of the underlying structural issues, and we also have spiraling climate chaos, you know, regardless. So we do need to be trying new things anyway. And another thing that occurred to me is how widespread and diverse the pushback to those public land sell-offs, like the attempted or floated sell-offs were, and things like even the roadless rule, which I didn't realize how up in arms even the hunting community would be about the rescission of the roadless rule, because, you know, a lot of hunters are truck hunters, right? But there has been massive pushback from that community in both of those fights. And I think, you know, something that occurs to me is like, maybe there, because this administration is so unhinged, right? Maybe that gives us the opportunity to make new allies and potentially uncomfortable allies in some spaces. But I mean, even my father, who lives out in far eastern Oregon and is hyper, hyper conservative, you know, he'll tell me even that he thinks that the public lands are overgrazed, right? So there are these inroads that we could be making. So maybe that is one thing for us to be trying.
Yeah. I don't know if it goes here or not, but I thought of a thing thinking about that. So
yeah.
One thing that I think, you know, we need to be, I agree with you that we need to be making better crossroads across and supportive of other people's efforts, sometimes that we don't agree with, and also sometimes that while we might agree with, like, you know, isn't necessarily within the NGO playbook or isn't easy to support. And so one of the things that And by easy support, I simply mean that we're all strapped for time,
yeah.
Like the capacity, particularly under the Trump administration, when so many things have been coming at us from every angle as attacks on public lands. And also funding is being cut for so many different kinds of conservation efforts, both at, you know, more the federal governmental level, as well as across the board in many other ways. And so everyone is scrambling for resources and funding at the same time that we're being pressed to our limits more for time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes, in a sense, even harder to reach across communities and see, like, oh, somebody is doing this amazing initiative, but they're really struggling with time and capacity. And so it's difficult to always support each other in the ways that I think we all really need to be supported. But, you know, I do want to take a minute to lift up, for example, there's a timber sale in southeastern, it actually hugs the border of southeastern Washington and eastern Oregon. It's the Tiger Mill Timber Sale in the Umatilla National Forest. And so, for example, there's been a lot of really amazing local activism in Walla Walla that while Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is totally impressed with and tries to, like, you know, keep in touch and support, it's independent activism that has just sort of come about because of so many local concerned people being upset about this timber sale that may affect their drinking water as well as these forests that are near them in surrounding watersheds or nearby watersheds. And so, you know, one of the things that those folks have been doing, I think Walla Walla Watershed is what they're the activist moniker that they're organizing under, and so or at least some of them, and so they're trying to organize right now a science series to try to, like, a confluence series is the name of it, that they're trying to invite more people in the local community as well as experts from different specialties to do educational series and also have more open discussions.
Hmm.
And so instead of, you know, like, kind of, you know, it's not exactly outside of the mold of similar things, but I think there's more of an emphasis on including local folks and also having more of actual, like, time and space for more in-depth education and discussion and questions and really getting into the nitty-gritty about what's important to protect in forests and space for debate about, you know, wildfire and forest ecology and things like this. So I'm excited about that. I just wanted to highlight that for a minute.
That sounds great. Yeah, I'd love to learn more about that. So unfortunately, I think we got to wrap up. I always love talking with you, Paula, and I was hoping to ask some questions that would push your buttons a little bit, but just because we've had some good debates in the past, but I think this is a good place to leave it. And before we do, is there anything we missed or anything you want to include in the discussion? And of course, one last time, you know, how do folks get involved in your work?
So how folks get involved in our work, visit our website, BlueMountainsBiodiversityProject.org, and sign up for our action alerts, and also check out the action alert page. In particular, we have a post about Blue Mountains forest plan revision process, as well as a landing page. And so if you're hearing this before October 6th, please comment. And we have talking points, instructions how to comment, links, etc. on our webpage. And if you're hearing this after then, still get engaged, because there will be other future public opportunity comments. And also, we want to keep up the pressure on the Forest Service, even when there's not a comment period open. And then if you're interested in volunteering for the field season, you can contact us through our website, or also, well, there's information on our website. And then also you can contact Karen Coulter, our director, who spearheads the field season. And her phone number is 541-385-9167. Or you can contact me, Paula, at BlueMountainsBiodiversityProject.org, all one word, lowercase. And so that's, you know, please do. You can also follow us on social media, you can follow us on social media. And I think maybe we'll have to have a part two someday when we debate some of the finer points around the things you are thinking about and pressing Paula's buttons.
Yeah, I would love that. I would love that. Well, until then, Paula, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for coming on the show. I'm so grateful to have someone with your wealth of knowledge and wisdom doing this great work. So thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Coast Range Radio is an independent production. If you like the show, please help me grow the audience, tell your friends about it, follow us on the Instagrams, all that good stuff. Once again, the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Reach out anytime. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
In to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Do you love rock and roll? Then tune in to KBOO every Friday afternoon at 3 for the Roots of Rock and Roll.